in where Vicente Barranco stood staring at the carnage. Chris wiped some of the blood off his face and grinned dizzily at him. The trembling was starting to set in. He tossed the bat to the floor, next to Echevarria's crumpled form.
"Okay, Vicente," he said shakily. "You tell me. Whose fucking side am I on?"
"You know, that wasn't the smartest thing I've ever seen you do."
Mike Bryant handed him the whiskey glass and went back to sit behind his desk. Chris huddled on the sofa in the blanket the paramedics had lent him, still shivering. In front of him, on the table, the chessboard pieces faced off against each other in the silence. The onyx gleamed.
"Sorry I hit you."
Mike rubbed at his chest.
"Yeah, with my own fucking bat. Could have done without that as well."
Chris sipped at the whiskey, both hands cupped around a glass as if it were hot coffee. The spirit went down, warming. He shook his head.
"I just lost it, Mike."
"Yeah, no shit."
Bryant glared at him.
"Think I spotted that one, too. Chris, what the fuck was Barranco doing at Sean unsupervised? You knew we had Echevarria in for budget review today. Why didn't you take Vicente out for a drive or something, or at least keep him in the Hilton until you could check with me?"
Chris shook his head again. The words limped out of his mouth. "I was running late. He went out without me."
"That doesn't explain how he got in here. Who cleared him for the tower?"
"That's what I tried to tell you earlier. Hewitt authorized a limo to bring him here."
Mike's eyes narrowed.
"Hewitt?"
"Yeah, Louise fucking Hewitt. I'm telling you, she's been gunning for me since the day I walked in here. She wants..."
"Ah, bullshit!"
Bryant came to his feet, hands braced on the desk. He shouted for the first time since the aftermath in the conference room.
"For Christ's sake! Now is not the fucking time for your bullshit paranoia and hurt feelings. This is serious."
The anger evaporated as fast as it had arrived. He sighed and sat down again, swiveled the chair away and stared out the window. One hand opened in Chris's direction.
"Well, I'm open to suggestions. What do you think we should tell Notley?"
"Does it matter what we tell him?"
"Fuck yes."
Mike jerked back around to look at him.
"What's the matter? You want to lose your job or something?"
Chris blinked.
"What?" "I said, do you want to lose your job?"
But...
Chris gestured helplessly and nearly dropped his whiskey.
"Mike, the job's already lost, isn't it?
I mean, you can't just go around clubbing the clients to death, can you?" "Oh, I'm glad you realize that now."
Mike, of course I don't want to lose this job. I like what I do."
Chris made the curious, prickling discovery that he was telling the truth.
"We're just getting somewhere important at last. I'm telling you, Barranco's the one. He can turn the whole name around if we get behind him. He can make it work. He can make us the..."
"What?" Mike Bryant was watching him narrowly.
"Go on."
"Mike, I'm good at this. The people stuff, you know that. And after this, I've got Barranco for keeps. We're close now, really close. This one matters."
"And Cambodia doesn't?"
"That's not what I mean. There's nothing new in Cambodia. They've been down this road at least 4 times before. Same old song, just a different decade. All we have to do is ride the wave and make sure the Enterprise Zones don't catch any damage. The name's different. You're looking at a radical restructuring of a regime that's been in place almost since the beginning of the century. How often do you get to do work like that anymore?"
Mike said nothing for a while. He seemed to be thinking. Then he nodded and got up from the desk.
"All right. Good. We'll go with that. Radical restructuring. Tone down the stuff about Cambodia, though. All our accounts are important, and whatever Sari eventually does or doesn't achieve, we stand to make a lot of money over there. Remember that."
Raised voices from outside Mike's office. The unmistakable tones of Louise Hewitt arguing with security. Mike made a wry face.
"Here we go," he said. "Block and cover. Start talking. And get rid of that fucking blanket. You look like an evicted criminal."
"What?"
"Something about the name, Chris. Relevant detail. Come on, quick. Try to sound intelligent."
Chris groped.
The urban situation's no better. Sure, you've got a pretty contented overclass, but that's only...
The blanket.
He shrugged it off, got up and started to pace, voice strengthening as he picked up the thread again, improvising.
The thing is, Mike, that business with the students was crucial. Some of those kids were from the overclass.
Okay, not many, but with an extended family system like the one you've got in the name, pretty much everybody knows someone who...
Louise Hewitt burst into the office.
What the fuck have you done, Faulkner?
He turned to look at her, and what struck him like a physical blow was how drop-dead gorgeous she looked angry. He'd always been aware that Hewitt was attractive in a hard, dark fashion, but it wasn't the kind of look that drew him. Too severe, too buttoned up, and in the end, let's be honest here, Chris, blonde was really what did it for him. Louise Hewitt was manifestly a dark-haired woman in utter control of her own destiny. It didn't help matters that he hated her guts. Now, with colour burning in her cheeks, her hair in light disarray and her jacket settled with less than perfect attention on her shoulders, he suddenly saw through to the woman beneath. She stood with legs braced slightly apart, as if the 52nd floor was the deck of a yacht in suddenly choppy waters, hands floating just off her hips like those of a movie gunfighter. The stance was unconsciously sensual, stretching the fabric of her narrow, knee-length skirt and highlighting the lines of her hips. One tiny part of Chris's mind stayed rational enough to register the bizarre perversity of his sexual programming. The rest of him was shit-scared of what was going to happen next.
"Louise," Mike Bryant said cheerfully, "there you are. I imagine you've heard, then."
"Heard? Heard?"
She advanced into the room, still half-focused on Chris.
"I've just come from the fucking sick bay, Mike. They've got Echevarria on a ventilator. What the fuck is going on?"
"Is he likely to die?"
Hewitt pointed her finger.
"I asked you a question, Mike. Spare me the executive deflection techniques."
"Sorry." Mike shrugged, force of habit. "The Echevarria end of things is played out. He was making the situation unmanageable."
"So you beat him to death?"
"It's unfortunate, but..."
"Unfortunate? Are you..."
Chris cleared his throat. "Louise, Barranco is..."
"You!"
She swung on him like combat.
"Shut the fuck up! You've done enough damage today."
Mike Bryant came out from behind his desk, hands lifted, soothing.
"Louise, we had no choice. It was lose Echevarria or lose Barranco, and Barranco is the key to this. He can turn the whole name around. If we get behind him, he can make it work."
Chris just stopped himself staring as he heard his own words coming out of Bryant's mouth. Hewitt looked from one man to the other. Her anger seemed to crank down a notch.
"That's not what Macon says."
"Well," Mike gestured, "that doesn't surprise me. Nick is running scared from his own mistakes. Come on, Louise, you know he's fumbled this one from the outset. Why else did you call me in?"
"Not to do this, that's for sure."
"Look, let's sit down for a moment."
Mike gestured at the sofas around the chess table.
"Come on. There's no point in yelling at each other. It's not an ideal situation, but it is manageable."
"Is it?"
Hewitt raised one immaculate eyebrow. Some of her customary cool seemed to be reasserting itself.
"This I've got to hear."
They sat. Mike bundled up the paramedic blanket and dumped it casually over the side of the sofa.
"The thing is, Louise, Vicente Barranco's our only shot. Echevarria was on his way out the door to the Americans. He was playing with us. And Barranco's the only viable insurgency alternative, Chris'll tell you. There are no other available choices."
Hewitt switched her gaze to Chris.
"Well?"
"Yeah." Chris tried to snap out of his daze at the suddenly civilized turn events had taken. He'd expected, by now, to be either sitting in a holding cell or clearing out his desk.
"Yeah, it's true. Our Benz is dead or dying of a collapsed immune system. MCH BioWare ammunition. And Diaz is either on the run or already caught, and we just haven't heard yet, in which case Echevarria's secret police will have tortured him to death by now."
"There you go."
Mike nodded along.
"Barranco's what we've got. And we nearly didn't have him an hour ago.
All we had was Echevarria getting ready to grab the hardware we'd advanced him and then kiss us goodbye and head out for Lloyd Paul or Calder's Rap Cap. And Barranco thinking we'd sold him out. Under the circumstances, I think Chris did the only thing that had any hope of salvaging the situation. Now at least we have a chance.
Hewitt shook her head.
This has got to go to Notley.
I agree. But it can go to Notley as a handled package, or it can go as a mess.
It is a mess, Mike. Barranco should never have been allowed anywhere near Echevarria in the first place.
We all make mistakes, Louise.
Something in Bryant's tone brought Hewitt around.
Meaning?
Well, you did authorize the limo for Barranco.
Mike was all innocence.
I mean, sure, you probably assumed that Chris would be here to meet him. And then Chris was at the Hilton instead, so...
Chris was fucking late, Louise Hewitt said delicately.
Yeah, that was a mistake. The limo was a mistake. Shit, it was my mistake, or Nick's, leaving the viewing chamber door open, not to mention the idiot who told Barranco where to find us. You're right, Louise, we have made a mess of this. But there's no percentage for any of us in presenting it that way to Notley. We need to accentuate the positive.
For a pair of seconds, Hewitt was silent. Chris could almost hear the whine of concentration as she played it through. Then she smiled sourly at both of them, and nodded.
All right, she said. Let's spin it, shall we?
Chapter 34 Echevarria died just before noon, of repeated internal hemorrhaging. He never regained consciousness. Vicente Barranco was there to watch him die. Everybody else was too busy. They'd been scrambling since Hewitt gave the green light.
Get his phone records from Brown's, she flung at them on her way out to find Notley. See if he posted any forward calls for this afternoon and find out if he was checking in with anyone regularly. That way we'll have some idea of how much time we've got to play with, and start coming up with a disposal plan.
Chris spent the next hour digging through files on useful terrorists. Mike Bryant's office became the command post. Chris commandeered the data down while Mike paced about with his cell talking to people. They sent Makin after the phone records. All incoming business got routed down to the 49th floor, where junior analysts had orders to shelve it unless there was a name connection. In the cleared space it gave them, they built the contingency plan. A Langley shadow unit was hired out of Miami, sent to find and track Echevarria Jr. The conference room recordings were isolated from all external data flow ports and played back on a standalone projector to a gray-haired data fake expert on assignment from Imagicians. The expert tut-tutted like a disappointed schoolmistress, hit replay and started making notes. A stony-faced internal security squad with high-level clearance arrived courtesy of Louise Hewitt, and Mike sent them to clean up the blood. Makin called in from Brown's with the phone data. There were no forward calls placed on Echevarria's account.
"Praise the Lord," said Mike,
doing Simeon Sands with remarkable good cheer given the circumstances. He flourished with his free hand.
"There is a God because I am saved. Good work, Nick."
"They give you any static down there?"
"Uh-huh."
"Good. No, but you never know. Bite the hair of the cliché that fed you and all that."
"What about regular stuff?"
"Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah, well to be expected, I guess."
"Yeah, we've got the hounds out in Miami."
"Yeah, Langley. Best we could do at short notice. They're on a tight leash."
"What?"
"Oh, come on, Nick, this isn't a fucking time for recrimin—"
"Yeah, well, I'm sure he knows that, too."
He glanced at Chris and rolled his eyes.
"Look, Nick, we haven't got the time for this. Pay them off, get copies of everything, and get back here."
He cut off the call, held the cell phone away from him, and massaged his ear.
"Like a dog with a fucking bone. Blame, 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 like it's going to fucking help now. So what do you reckon, Elaine?"
The data fake expert froze the tape and raked a hand through her silvered hair. On the pastel-shaded wall, Chris towered 4 meters tall, leaning into the swing, face blind with fury.
"Does it need to stand up in court?"
"No, nothing like that." She shrugged.
So we can fix it. Just tell me what you want.
Okay, good. Chris, how you doing? Chris nodded the data down. Got a few possibilities, yeah, but Mike, none of these guys have pulled off a successful bombing in London for years. Yeah, well, they won't have to. All they need do is claim responsibility. There ought to be plenty of the little fuckers up for that. No effort, no risk, instant media coverage. What more could they want? Mike flicked a finger at the screen. What about them? They look ugly enough. No good, Chris shook his head. Christian militants, anti-gay, anti-abortion, no axe to grind. Besides, they're too fucking inept for anyone to believe they could get something like this together. Yeah, but... Mike's phone queeped in his hand. Yeah, Bryant? Uh-huh. All right, thanks. What about the other one? Uh-huh. Okay, well, keep him that way, then. Now I don't know how long. All right? Yes. Goodbye.
He weighed the phone in his hand and looked pensively at it.
Echevarri is dead, just now. Dead and cooling fast. And Nick reckoned he promised to call his son in Miami sometime this evening. We're losing our window.
In the end, they opted for a group of antique revolutionary socialists with a complicated acronym no one was likely to remember very well. The group had enjoyed a sudden resurgence in recent years, drawing disaffected zone youth in a number of European cities, staging the machine gun assassination of low-level executives, and causing big explosions in, or at least in the vicinity of, rather vaguely designated globalist strongholds. They'd managed to kill nearly 24 people in the last 5 years, often including their intended targets. They used a wide range of military-grade automatic weapons and explosive devices, acquired mainly through Russian black market channels, and very easy to get hold of. Their justificatory rhetoric was a dense mesh of outmoded, Trotskyist sentiment and anti-corporate eco-babble, and it appeared they spent almost as much energy purging the ranks and backbiting as they did killing people. Sean's infiltration ops wing had labelled them noisy, but essentially harmless. They were perfect. Mike went to get fitted for a Weblar vest. Chris was chasing down the hardware when Jack Notley walked into the office unannounced and stood looking around with the nonchalance of someone on a guided tour. His Susanna Ingram jacket was buttoned closed, and he held his hands lightly clasped in front of him. He nodded pleasantly at the imagician's consultant who'd been back and forth from the imaging studio down the hall with variations on the requested footage, and now, in Mike's absence, was packing up her stuff.
"Elaine! Glad to see we're keeping you busy. Wouldn't be here otherwise, Jack." "No, I suppose not."
Notley's gaze switched to Chris, and he lost his smile. His eyes were unreadable.
"And you? Are you busy as well?"
Chris fought down a tremor. We're pretty much done here, but I need to check in with Vicente Barranco. He's been...
"I've had Signor Barranco taken back to his hotel. Elaine, could you give us a few minutes?"
"Sure. I'm done here, anyway. I'll come back for this stuff later." She slipped out. Chris watched her go with a pang of envy. Notley came around the desk to stand at his shoulder.
"What are you doing?"
he asked flatly.
"Hardware profile."
Chris gestured at the screen, scrabbling after composure. He found, oddly, that he was more embarrassed than afraid.
"We found a group to take the fall for Echevarria. I'm matching most used weapons against our local inventory. We'll need to use our own people, of course. There's no time for anything else."
"No. We are pressed for time, aren't we?"
"Yes. Although, to be honest, it's probably better this way." His throat was dry. It lowers our exposure, and it means we can control the situation.
"Control? Yes."
He felt Notley move behind him, out of his peripheral field of view. It took an effort of will not to twist around in the seat. Now the warm blush of embarrassment was shredding away into cold fear. The senior partner's voice was hypnotically tranquil at his back. It felt like hands laid on his shoulders.
"Remind me, Chris, why are we in this situation, exactly?"
Chris swallowed. He drew a deep breath.
"Because I fucked up." "Yes."
Now Notley had moved back into peripheral view on the left.
"Putting it mildly, you have indeed
Fucked. Up. He came around the side of the desk, and he had the Nemex leveled. This time there was no fighting down the tremor. Chris flinched, violently. Notley stared at him. There was nothing in his face at all.
"Is there anything you want to say to me?"
Chris felt the pounding calm of a road duel descend on him. He measured angles, knew he was caught. His replacement Nemex was back in his own office, still not out of the factory wrapping. The desk pinned him. He couldn't rush Notley, and there was nothing on the desktop worth throwing. He was used to making these calculations at combat speed, measuring and acting in the time it took for the Saab to cover a handful of asphalt meters. The immobility and the limping timescale made it unreal, a floating fragment of a dream. The supermarket swam before his eyes, the painful bang of the gun in his ears, the sudden warm rain of blood. He wondered if...
Well?
I think... Suddenly it was easy. All he had to do was let go.
I think you're making a big fucking mistake. Echevarria was a bag of pus waiting to burst. All I did was save you the trouble.
Notley's eyes narrowed. Then, out of nowhere, he lowered the Nemex and tucked it away in his waistband. He shook his head.
Nice image, that. A bag of pus waiting to burst. Charming. You need to refine your act, Faulkner.
He cast about and found a chair, pulled it up to the desk and sat down. Chris gaped at him, still swamped in chemicals by a nervous system expecting to be shot. Notley smiled.
"Tell you a story," he said comfortably. "Guy called Webb Ellis. Went to my old school about 200 years before I did. What does that tell you, incidentally?"
Chris blinked. He was rich?
Very good. Not wholly accurate, but close enough. Webb Ellis was what these days we'd call jacked in. He had connections. Father died when he was still young, but his mother bootstrapped him up on those connections, and come 16 he was still a student. Among other things, he played a pretty sharp game of soccer and cricket, and apparently during one of those soccer games he broke the rules pretty severely by picking up the ball and running with it. You know what happened to him?
Sent off?
Notley shook his head. No. He got to be famous. They built a whole new game around running with the ball.
That's... Chris frowned. Rugby.
That's right. In the end they named it after the school. You can see why. Webb Ellis ball would have been a bit of a mouthful. But that's the legend of how rugby got started. There's even a plaque on the wall at the school commemorating old Webb Ellis and the day he broke the rules. I used to walk past it every day.
Quiet soaked into the room. Is that true? Chris asked finally. Notley grinned.
No, probably not. It's just a useful piece of school mythology graven in stone to resemble the truth. But it is representative, in all likelihood, of what a whole gang of different elite school kids were doing at around that time. Breaking the rules, and making up new ones. Later that century, you get a formalized game, and creative back marketing lays it at the door of one man because that's what people relate to. But the interesting thing is this, Chris. The game was never new. It dates back to Roman times, at least. They've been playing games just like it for centuries in the streets of villages and towns all over Britain. And you know what? Just around the time Webb Ellis and his friends were making sporting history, the common people were being told, by law and by big uniformed men with sticks and guns, that they weren't allowed to play this game any more. Because, and this is close to a quote, it disturbed the public order and was dangerous. Do you see, Chris, how these things work? How they've always worked?
Chris said nothing. It wasn't 5 minutes since this man had held a gun on him. He didn't trust the ice enough to walk on yet.
Okay. Notley leaned back in the chair. Fast forward a couple of centuries. Here's something you should know. Who made the first competition roadkill?
Roberto Sanchez, wasn't it? Called a Chicago Partnership Challenge back in... No, wait a minute. Chris sieved an unexpected chunk of information from the sea of TV junk he'd been letting wash over him in recent months. Now they're saying it wasn't Sanchez. It was this guy Rice, real thug from the Washington office. He beat Sanchez to it by about 3 months or something. Notley nodded. He seemed, for a moment, to be lost in thought.
Yes, they say that. They also say it was Begoña Salas over at Iberfondos. That's the feminist revisionist angle, but it holds some water. Salas was cutting edge around then, and she always drove like a fucking maniac. There's another school of thought that says Calder's stole the idea from a strategic thought unit in California. That firms like Ocko Holdings and the Sacramento Group were already trialing it secretly. You want to know what I remember?
Once again the distance behind Notley's look, the sense that most of him was suddenly elsewhere.
Sure. What?
Notley smiled gently.
I remember it being me.
Fleetingly, Chris recalled his first impression of the senior partner the day he came to work at Shawn, like a troll in the elf pastel shades of the interview room. He looked at Notley now, at the brutal crackle of power about the man, shoehorned into the Susanna Ingram like too much upper body muscle, and an initial urge to match the partner smile for smile slid abruptly away. His pulse began to pick up slowly. Notley seemed to shake himself.
It was a different time, Chris. We're all used to it now. But back then you could smell the change in the air.
He breathed in, deep.
Fresh, like spilled fuel, reeking with potential. The domino recessions had come and gone. We'd been bracing ourselves for it all that time, for the worst we could imagine, and it came and went, and we were all still standing. Better than still standing. We'd barely missed a step. A few riots, a few banks out of business, that nuclear nonsense in the Punjab. We surfed it, Chris. We rode it out. It was easy.
He paused. He seemed to be waiting for something to fill the gap. Chris hurried to oblige, mesmerized by the intensity coming across the desk at him. You still had to drive, though, right?
Oh, yes.
A casual gesture.
The domino gave us competitive driving. Hard-edged solution for hard-edged times, but it was still pretty civilized back then, still pretty close to its roots. You know how road raging started?
Chris stumbled, wrong-footed. What? Yeah, sure. Those formula cars, ones you see on the history channels, looked like little rockets, right? They started getting owned by the same people who made the money, and then, with the roads empty and everything. He stopped. Notley was shaking his head. No?
Not really. Well, yes, sure, you had that dynamic. That's part of it, I suppose. But it all goes back a lot farther than that. Back to late last century. The pre-millennial stuff. Stuff my father told me about. Back then, some of the harder-nosed firms were already experimenting with conflict incentives for their new recruits. It was an American thing. 8 trainees in a section, sectional office space, and only 7 desks.
Notley made a QED motion with both hands.
So, get to work last, you had to work on a window ledge. Or beg space from someone with a better alarm clock. Let that happen to you more than a couple of times, you can see how the group dynamic starts to lean. The late guy's the weakest link. So the rest gang up on him. Chimp behavior. Lend him your desk space and you're weak by association. You're making the wrong alliances, so you don't do it. You can't afford to.
Chris couldn't decide, but he thought he saw a faint distaste rising in Notley's eyes. Or maybe it was just the energy again.
Now, you transfer that idea, not just for trainees, but for everyone. Think about the times. The domino recessions are scratching at the door. You've got to do something. Most investment houses and major corporations are waterlogged with top-end personnel. Ex-politicians on sinecure non-executive directorships, useless executive directors shipped around on an old-boy network from golden handshake to golden handshake, headhunted bright young things staying the obligatory 2 years, then shipped out for the next move up on rep vapor and nothing else. Because I ask you, what, in 2 years, have you really achieved in a corporate post? And that's just how we were fucking things up at the Anglo end of the cultural scale.
Elsewhere you got fuckwit younger sons and daughters being cut in on Daddy's pie straight out blatantly, because in those cultures who's going to tell Daddy otherwise? And all of this is teetering on the brink, as the dominoes start to fall. Something has to be done. At a minimum, something has to be seen to be done. Something harsh. So what do? You go right back to that 8 trainee section with 7 desks, and you extrapolate. Late to work, you don't lose your desk. You lose your job. At a time when you had 12 identically qualified people for every real executive post, why not? It was as real as any other measure. You sure as hell couldn't depend on sales figures or productivity, not with a global economy in a tailspin, and since no one could afford to lose a job at a time like that, you got some pretty fierce driving. Some genuine road rage. But back then, Notley produced another of his smiles, wintry this time. Back then, it was still enough to just get there first. Do you have anything to drink in here?
Chris gestured across at Mike Bryant's brushed steel built-in drinks cabinet.
I don't know, it's Mike's office. He'll have some stuff in there. I imagine so.
Notley hulked to his feet and wandered over to the cabinet.
You want anything?
I've got to... He nodded at the data down. You know, finalize the, An impatient wave.
So finalize it. I'll make you a drink in the meantime. What do you want?
Whiskey. Lafraig, if it's there. He knew Mike kept that around. He produced it with a flourish every time they ended up in the office late. Chess juice, he'd taken to calling it.
Just a small one. No ice.
Notley grunted.
Think I'll join you. I'm a gin man myself, but I'm buggered if I can see any in here.
Chris bent to the data down, nailed the explosives along with the cheap Russian machine pistols he'd already selected, and thumbed it all down to issuing, tagged with Mike's notification code. Notley placed a brimming tumbler at his elbow, swallowed some of his own drink, and glanced over the on-screen detail.
You done? Good. So put on a tolerant expression and listen to the old man's story.
He went back to the seat and hunched forward over his drink.
Let's see. I was working at Calder's UK. I would have been, what, 27, 28, something like that? Younger than you, anyway. About as stupid, though.
No smile with that. Notley took another chunk off his drink.
I had this promotion playoff. Not the first I'd driven, not even one of the first. But it was the first time I thought I might be in trouble. Barnes, the other analyst, was my age. Good rep, on the road and off, and he drove this flame-red Ferrari Roadster. Very fast, but very lightweight. Nothing like the ones they make now. I was on Audis at the time, no choice back then, it was what I could afford. Good wagon, in its own way, but heavy, very heavy.
No change there, then. For the first time in the conversation, Chris felt he was on familiar ground. Notley shrugged carelessly.
Armouring is what they do. Same with BMW. Maybe it's a German thing. Look, I knew if I could just get in front of Barnes, I could hold him off all the way there. Nothing that little roadster could do to my back end that wouldn't straighten out in the shop. Back then it was the rule everybody knew. You didn't have to kill anyone, you just had to get to work first. So that was it. Get ahead, stay ahead, block and cover. And I had Barnes like that every mile till the last. Then the little cunt slipped past me.
He raised his eyebrows, maybe at his own sudden profanity.
To this day I don't know how he did it. Maybe I was too confident. Maybe it was a gear change I left too loose. Do that on a heavy wagon, you know how it is. Suddenly you're underpowered.
Chris nodded. It happened to me a couple of times before I got the Saab.
Yeah, you've got that spaced armouring now, right?
Yeah. He wasn't sure if it was the whiskey or just the slide after the hours of tension and the roller coaster ride of facing Notley's gun, but Chris could feel himself starting to relax. Works like a dream. I hear BMW are trying to get past the patents and do their own version.
Quite possibly.
Notley stared into his glass.
But we were talking about Barnes. Barnes and that last bend on the overhead as you come into the 11 off-ramp. It used to be a lot narrower then, barely even a double lane. We hit it with Barnes ahead, and I knew there was no way past him. And the way I remember it, There was no Roberto Sanchez making headlines then. No Harry Rice, either. Could be it was just still under wraps, all denial and cover-up, until Calder's decided what needed to go into the shredder and what they could get away with. But I don't remember any precedent. I just remember fury. Fury that I was going to lose by a couple of fucking meters.
He took another mouthful of whiskey and held on to it. Swallowed. Grimaced.
So I pushed him off. Down a gear, pedal flat, revs up to the red on that last bend. Into the back of that little roadster as if I was giving it one up the arse. I went through the crash barrier like a fist through tissue paper, right over and nose first into the Calder's parking lot. Hit another car and one of the tanks blew, then the other one. By the time I got down there, it was all over. But they showed me security camera footage later.
Notley looked up and gave Chris a grin that slipped just a little.
He tried to get out. Was almost out when the tank went. There was this 2-minute sequence of Roger Barnes lit up in flame, still tangled in the belt. He tore free. He was screaming. Screaming all the way. It must have been the pain that got him out, finally. He ran about a dozen steps on fire, and then he just seemed to melt. Collapsed and folded over himself there on the asphalt. And stopped screaming. And the next time I checked, I was a pin-up. Magazine covers, car ads. Introduced to the CEO of Calder's in Chicago. It was out in the open all of a sudden. It was precedent, Chris. It was legal. And Calder's were the new field leaders, pointing the way out of the domino trap. Turn up with blood on your wheels or don't turn up at all. It was the new ethic, and we were the new breed. Jack Notley, Roberto Sanchez, transatlantic mirror images of the same new brutalist dynamic, worth our body weight in platinum.
Notley seemed to have coasted to a halt. He looked up at Chris again.
President, Chris. That's what counts. Remember Webb Ellis? In the elite, you don't get punished for breaking the rules. Not if it works. If it works, you get elevated, and the rules get changed in your wake. Now, tell me Barranco is going to work.
Chris cleared his throat. It'll work. The name's a special place. We're talking about the radical restructuring of a regime that's been in place almost since the beginning of the century. It's time for that change. Echevarri was just
a bag of pus waiting to be... I remember. Go on.
With Barranco, we can build a whole new monitored economy. He believes in things, he believes in change, and he can get other people to believe. That's a power we can harness. We can use it to build something out there that no one in this fucking business has ever seen before. Something that gives people... It was the whiskey. He clamped shut. Notley watched him, features shrewd and attentive. He nodded, set his whiskey on the edge of the desk, and got up. Abruptly the Nemex was in his hand again, but gripped flat in his upheld palm.
"Careful,"
he said, enunciating the word as if to demonstrate its meaning.
"I like you, Chris. If I didn't, make no mistake about this, they'd be taking you out of here in plastic. I think you've got what not one Sean exec in 10 has, what we can't ever get enough of around here, and that's the ability to create. To build new models in your head without even realizing you're doing it. You're a change-maker, and we have to have the guts to let you be what you are, to take the risk that you may fuck up, and to trust that you won't. But you need to be clear on what we're about here, Chris. Sean exists to make money. For our shareholders, for our investors, and for ourselves, in that order. We're not some last-century bleeding-heart NGO pissing funds into a hole in the ground. We're part of a global management system that works. 40 years ago we dismantled OPEC, now the Middle East does as we tell it. 20 years ago we dismantled China, and East Asia got in line as well. We're down to micromanagement and the market now, Chris. We let them fight their mindless little wars, we rewrite the deals and the debt, and it works. Conflict investment is about making global stupidity work for the benefit of Western investors. That's it. That's the whole story. We're not going to lose our grip again like last time.
I didn't mean...
Yes, you did. And it's natural to feel that way sometimes, above all when you're rubbing up against someone like Branko. You said it yourself. He can make other people believe. Do you think, just because you wear a suit and drive a car, that you're immune to that?
Notley shook his head.
Hope is the human condition, Chris. Belief in a better day. For yourself, and if they really get to you, for the whole fucking world. Give Branko time, and he'll have you believing in that. A world where the resources get magically shared out like some global birthday tea for well-behaved kids. A world where everyone's beaming, content with a life of hard work, modest rewards, and simple pleasures. I mean, think about it, Chris. Is that a likely outcome? A likely human outcome?
Chris licked his lips, watching the gun.
No, of course not. I just meant that Branko is...
But Notley wasn't listening. He was lit up with a whiskey and something else that Chris couldn't get a fix on. Something that looked like desperation but wore an industrial wattage grin.
Do you really think we can afford to have the developing world develop? You think we could have survived the rise of a modern articulated Chinese superpower 20 years ago? You think we could manage an Africa full of countries run by intelligent, uncorrupted democrats? Or a Latin America run by men like Branko? Just imagine it for a moment. Whole populations getting educated and healthy and secure and aspirational. Women's rights, for Christ's sake. We can't afford these things to happen, Chris. Who's going to soak up our subsidized food surplus for us? Who's going to make our shoes and shirts? Who's going to supply us with cheap labor and cheap raw materials? Who's going to store our nuclear waste, balance out our CO2 misdemeanors? Who's going to buy our arms?
He gestured angrily.
An educated middle class doesn't want to spend 11 hours a day bent over a stitching machine. They aren't going to work the seaweed farms and the paddy fields till their feet rot. They aren't going to live next door to a fuel rod dump and shut up about it. They're going to want prosperity, Chris, just like they've seen it on TV for the last 100 years. City lives, and domestic appliances, and electronic game platforms for their kids, and cars, and vacations, and places to go to spend their vacations, and planes to get them there. That's development, Chris. Ring any bells? Remember what happened when we told our people they couldn't have their cars anymore? When we told them they couldn't fly? Why do you think anybody else is going to react any differently out there?
I don't. Chris spread his hands. He couldn't work out how things had gotten back up to this pitch.
I know this stuff. I don't need convincing, Jack.
Notley stopped abruptly. He drew a deep breath and let it out, hard. He seemed to become aware of the Nemex in his hand for the first time. He grimaced and put it away.
My apologies. Shouldn't touch the hard stuff this early.
He picked up his glass from the edge of the desk and drained it.
So, getting back to practicalities, you've got the disposal handled?
Yeah, we pinned the wrap on the CE. I mean CA. Chris gave up and gestured at the screen. These guys. Mike's down sorting out the limo and the logistics, but basically we're all set.
Louise tells me there's another body. Echevarria had an adjutant, is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
And I understand you battered him, too, in the same rather impulsive fashion you took care of Echevarria.
Yes, he got in the way. Notley raised an eyebrow.
That was inconsiderate of him? So is he dead?
No, not yet. Chris hurried into explanation. But that's okay. Sick bay have him on life support, sedated until we're ready. In fact, that's one of the strengths of the way we've set this up. If I can just show you that...
No, that won't be necessary. As I said before, this is about having the guts to let you run with the ball.
A faint smile.
Just like our old friend, Webb Ellis. Illustrious company you find yourself in, Chris Faulkner. Maybe they'll put up a plaque for you, too, one day.
Chapter 35. He caught it on the radio as he drove home. Some general news reporter from the scene. A woman, but not... Cut that out.
were shocked by this terrorist attack in the heart of London's West End. I'm standing outside the famous Brown's Hotel, only a few metres from the spot where less than an hour ago visiting Head of State General Hernan Echevarria and his aide, Lieutenant Colonel Rafael Carrasco, were fired upon by masked gunmen. Details aren't clear as yet, but it seems two men opened fire with machine pistols as General Echevarria was brought to his hotel in a Shawn Associates limousine. The General's aide and an unnamed Shawn executive were both hit by machine gun fire as they exited the vehicle ahead of the General. The terrorists then threw some kind of anti-personnel grenade into the interior and made their escape on a motorcycle. All three men and the driver of the limousine have been rushed to intensive care at...
He turned it off. He knew the rest. Michael Bryant, thrown miraculously clear of the explosion, recovers from gunshot wounds in the hospital. The limo driver, protected by the armoured partition, gets off with burns, abrasions, and shock. General Echevarria and his aide go home in body bags, scorched and shell and shrapnel riddled beyond useful autopsy. State funeral, full military honours, rifles volley, women weep, closed caskets, everybody in black. In the Highlands, Barranco's insurgents stir to freshly equipped life. You're a change-maker, Chris. He felt it rising in him, stirring like the hard-eyed men and women in the name jungle. He saw himself, embodied purpose, rushing over asphalt in the darkness, carving a path with the Saab's high beams like some furious avatar of the forces he was setting in motion on the other side of the globe. Riding the quiet power of the engine across the night, face masked in the soft backwash of dashboard light, bulletproof, careproof, unstoppable. He called Barranco at the Hilton. You heard?
Yes, it's on the TV. I'm watching it now.
For the first time that Chris could remember, Barranco's voice sounded unsure.
You are okay?
Chris grinned in the dark. Yeah, I'm okay.
I would not have believed something like that. To do something like that. In front of your colleagues, in your situation. I did not expect.
Skip it, Vicente. The old fuck had it coming. Barranco was silent.
Yes, that is true.
And more silence across the connection, like snow drifting to the ground on the other side of the world. For a beat, Chris could feel the cold out there, like something alive, like something looking for him.
I saw him die, said Barranco.
Chris shook himself. Good. I hope that was worth something to you, Vicente. I hope you feel avenged.
Yes, it is good to know he is dead.
When the Colombian showed no further sign of speaking, Chris cleared his throat.
Listen, Vicente, get some rest. With what's coming down in the next few weeks, you're going to need it. Plane's not till noon, so sleep in. Lopez'll get you up in plenty of time.
Silence sifting down.
Chris?
Yeah, still here.
They aren't going to punish you for this?
No one's going to punish me for anything, Vicente. Everything's under control. And you and I are going right to the top of this thing together. I give it 6 months before you're in the streets of Bogota. Now get some sleep. I'll see you tomorrow.
He waited for a reply. When there was none, he shrugged, cut the connection, and gave himself to the driving. Change maker. He got off at the Elsinham ramp and picked up the road east, pushing the Saab faster than was smart. The car jolted in potholes, and the engine grew shrill as he dropped gears late on the bends. Trees stood at the roadside, sudden and dusty looking in the glare of the Saab's lights. When he got to Hawkesbury Green, he shed some of his speed, but he was still rolling too fast. The car snarled angrily to itself as he took the turn into the driveway, and he had to lean on the brakes. He killed the high beams. Up ahead in the sudden dark, the house security lights flared to life. He frowned and glanced at the ID broadcast set. A tiny green active light glowed back at him, reassuring as far as it went. He felt tension go stealing along his nerves, wondering if Notley had, after all, gone conservative on him and sent night callers with silenced guns. The Saab crunched up the winding drive. He reached across to the glove compartment and opened it. The Nemex fell out into his palm, still slightly greasy from the factory wrapping oils. He straightened up again and cleared the last bend. Carla was waiting for him, wrapped tight in a terry-cloth robe, hair wet and straggling. Backlit by the security system's lamps, he looked like the ghost of a drowned woman. When she bent to his window, face hard-boned from the wet and the lack of makeup, he almost jumped. He stopped the Saab short and opened the window.
"What are you doing out here? You'll catch your death of cold." "Was fick," she said. "He just called."
The rest of the week snapped by like scenery. He got Barranco out of the country, got final signatures on the regime term sheets on the way to the airport. Sandwiched between Lopez and Chris in the helicopter, Barranco signed it all like a man under sedation. Chris waved him goodbye from the asphalt. He dropped in on Mike at the hospital. The other executive had nothing worse than severe bruising across the ribcage from the machine gun fire, but it seemed politic to keep him in the intensive care unit for a few days at least. There were news crews lining up in the corridor outside, but Sean security had them managed.
"So now you're a fucking celebrity."
Mike grinned from a chair beside the bed. There were a couple of small cuts on his face, and his left hand was bandaged. He got up, wincing with the effort.
"You see Liz out there?"
he asked.
"No. You expecting her?"
"Never know."
Mike poured himself a drink from a pitcher beside the bed.
"Nah, to be honest, she'd be the last thing I need right now. I'm in enough pain just breathing heavily. You want some of this?"
"What is it?"
"What does it look like? Juice."
"Maybe later. What happened to your face?"
"Ah," Mike waved dismissively. "Did it myself with a broken bottleneck beforehand. Good for the media to see a real wound or two, I reckon."
"And the hand?"
A scowl.
"Sprained my wrist going down on the pavement, like a fucking idiot. I was trying to keep Carrasco upright for the machine gun, like this, and then dive out of the way, this way, when they tossed in the grenade. It was awkward."
"Any witnesses?"
Bryant shook his head.
"Monday night, and it's a quiet street anyway. A couple of people might have looked our way once the firing started, maybe, but too late to notice anything odd. There'll be footage from the hotel security cameras. Maybe that street scanner we couldn't mask out at the corner of Stafford Street. Elaine's already on it. No problem, she says. Barranco, get off, okay?"
Back at Sean, Chris sat in the covert viewing chamber while Nick Makin and Louise Hewitt talked to Francisco Echevarria by uplink. The young man was pale and hollow-eyed, and it was clear he had been crying. From the way he kept looking off to the side, it was also clear he was not alone in the projection room at the other end. Hewitt conveyed smooth corporate sympathies and encouraged him not to concern himself with contractual details at such a time. Sean's own principal officer for the name account was in any case unable to leave the hospital for the foreseeable future. There was no sense in rushing into anything. Sean C.I. would be very happy to put the whole issue on ice until the family felt more able to deal with the negotiations. "By which time Barranco will have your worthless nuts in the fucking vice, you and your whole stinking Hacienda clan." The sudden violence of his own thoughts took Chris by surprise. Francisco Echevarria flickered out. They adjourned to Hewitt's office to discuss a tentative calendar for Barranco's revolution. He went down to the 49th floor to thank the junior execs who had covered the other accounts for them while the crisis was in full swing. He took gifts: cask-strength Isla single malt, Galapagos bourbon, ground coffee, single estate Andalus olive oil, and got into mock sparring sessions with a couple of the known hard cases in the section. No full-force blows, he stayed just the right side of friendly, but he pushed hard and fast and got close-up body contact each time. It wasn't wise to show raw gratitude untempered by signs of strength. It could get taken the wrong way. He got back his caseload, started mechanically through the detail, building back up to operational pitch where necessary. He took a basket of Indonesian fruit and a crate of Turkish export beer up to the hospital, and found Liz Linshaw sitting on the corner of Mike's bed. Mike sat there grinning like a post-blowjob idiot. Liz was a study in her usual off-screen, rough-and-ready elegance. She showed Chris exactly the civilized blend of camaraderie and casual flirtation that he remembered from their earliest meetings. The downshift cut him to the quick.
"Listen, Chris," Mike said finally, waving a hand at the bedside seat Liz wasn't using. "We've been talking about your no-namer problem. Liz says she could ask around, no problem."
"That's great," he looked across at her. "Thanks."
"My pleasure."
It was more than he could handle. He caught himself with a barbed comment about Suki rising to his lips and called time. He made workload excuses and got out. As he opened the door to go, Liz Linshaw called him back.
"Chris, I'll be in touch," she said.
Back at Shawn, he went down to the gym and did an hour of full contact with the auto bag. He worked late. He took the Nemex to the firing ranges and emptied 2 dozen clips into the ghost dance of holo targets there. The machine scored him high on accuracy and speed, abysmally low on selection. He'd killed too many innocent bystanders. And then it was Saturday. It was time. Chapter 36. There were police trucks gathered at the entrance to the Brundtland. Revolving blue lights slashed the poorly lit walkways and stair stacks with monotonous regularity, each touch fleeting and then gone, giving way again to the gloom. Flashlight beams and bulky armored figures moved on the exterior walkways. An amp box blattered across the night. "Ah, fuck." Chris braked the Land Rover to a halt. Carla stared out at the lights, wide-eyed.
"Do you think?"
"I don't know. Stay here."
He left the engine running and climbed down, digging in his pocket for corporate ID, hoping the Nemex didn't show under the jacket. A body-armored police sergeant noticed the new arrival and detached himself from the knot of figures beside the trucks. He strode across the cracked concrete, flashlight and sidearm held high.
"You can't come in here."
Chris held his ID out in the beam. "I'm visiting someone. What's going on?"
"Oh."
The sergeant's tone shifted, abruptly conciliatory. He holstered his pistol.
"Sorry, sir. With what you're driving, you know, I didn't realize."
"Don't worry about it." Chris manufactured a grin of forbearance. "Easy mistake to make. My wife's wheels. Sentimental value. So what's going on here?"
"It's drugs, sir. Bathroom edge. A couple of the local gangwits have been bad boys, exporting their product across the line, dealing in the Kensington catchment, hanging around the schools and such."
The sergeant grimaced in the flashlight beam and shook his head.
"Not the first time, either. And the community leaders have been warned before, so it's the next step. We've been told to turn up the heat on cases like this. You know how it's done, sir. Break a few doors, break a few heads. Only thing gets through to these animals in the end."
"Sure. Look, I need to get up to the 5th floor and see my father-in-law. It's quite urgent. Can you do something about that?"
Hesitation. Chris switched on the grin again, reached carefully into his jacket pocket, well above the Nemex. "I understand it's trouble you don't need right now, but it is important. I'd be very grateful." The light gleamed off the edges of the racked plastic and the Shawn Associates holo logo on the front card. At the back, the wallet was stiff with a thick sheaf of cash. The sergeant was looking down at it like someone afraid of falling.
"5th floor, he said.
"That's right."
"Just a moment, sir."
He dug out a phone and thumbed it to life.
"Gary, you there? Listen, are we working on 5? No? So what's the nearest?" "Okay, thanks."
He stowed the phone. Chris handed across a slice of currency.
"Should be safe enough to go up there, sir. I'll have a couple of my men take you up, just to be sure."
He folded the notes into his palm with an awkwardness that bespoke lack of practice and looked back at the Land Rover.
"Your wife, too?"
"Yeah, tell the truth. She wants to be here a lot more than I do."
Their escort took the form of 2 helmeted, body-armored uniforms with pump-action shotguns and hip-holstered pistols. They bounded from the rear of the reserve truck like eager dogs when their names were called. One was white, one was black, and neither looked old enough to be shaving yet.
They covered angles in the stairwell with a kind of self-conscious intensity that on older men might have looked like professionalism, and once or twice they grinned at each other. The white kid chewed gum mechanically throughout, and the black kid appeared to be rapping under his breath. They both seemed to be enjoying themselves. When the party reached the fifth floor, Chris gave them a 50 apiece, and they clattered back down the stairs with what sounded like none of the drilled caution they'd exhibited on the way up. Carla knocked at the door of 57. Eric answered, looking haggard.
"I tried to call. The police."
"Just talk to them," said Chris, luxuriating in the advantage. "It's an edge bust. Nothing to worry about." Eric Nyquist's mouth tightened.
"Yes, I forgot," he said thinly. "A different matter when you're a member of the elite, isn't it? When—"
"Dad!"
"Maybe we could come in," added Chris.
Nyquist gave him a venomous look, but he stood aside and they filed through into the living room. Behind him, Chris heard the door being locked and bolted. Almost as loud, through the cardboard-thin walls of the room, he could hear raised voices from the apartment next door, and what sounded like a baby crying. He glanced around the cramped living space, kept an expression of distaste off his face with an effort, and seated himself gingerly in one of the battered armchairs. He looked up as Nyquist followed Carla into the room.
"Getting on with the neighbors okay?" he asked brightly, nodding toward the noise next door. "Sounds a little below your level of intellectual debate."
"Interfering fucking cunt," came leaking through the wall. Eric looked at him stonily.
"He's a dealer. He's probably expecting to have his skull caved in by your stormtroopers out there."
"No danger of that. Their commander told me they're not working this floor. Want me to go next door and tell him?"
"In those clothes?" Eric sneered. "He'd probably stab you as soon as look at you."
"He could try."
"Oh, yes, I forgot. I have a professional killer for a son-in-law."
Chris rolled his eyes and was on his way to his feet when he caught a glare from Carla that stopped him.
"Dad, that's enough."
Nyquist looked at his daughter and sighed.
"All right," he said. "Let's get on with this."
Chris clapped his hands together, pistol shot loud. The voices next door stopped abruptly.
"Suits me. So where is Vasvik? Hiding in the toilet?"
Carla made an angry gesture at him. Eric moved to a table loaded with bottles and glasses. His voice was toneless with suppressed anger. He picked up a bottle and studied the label intently.
"Perhaps you'd like to act as if you were civilized for a change, Chris. I'm aware that the strain might be too much, but maybe you should try. This man is a guest in my house, and he, in fact everyone in this room, is taking chances for your benefit."
"Glimmed it, Eric."
Truls Vasvik had appeared in the living room doorway, scruffily dressed and running stubble. He looked tired.
"Faulkner's here to negotiate, just like me. The only favors he owes are to you for getting involved."
Chris shook his head.
"You're wrong about that, Vasvik. I'm not here to negotiate. I've told you what I want, and it's not negotiable. Simple yes or no will do."
"Well, then."
Vasvik dropped into the other armchair, eyes speculative on Chris's face.
"The answer is yes. Your neck will take you. But I'm afraid there's a catch. A sub-clause, I guess you'd call it."
Chris looked up at Carla, whose face had gone from tension to relieved delight to puzzlement in as many seconds. He felt a petty, jeering sense of vindication rising in him.
"What sub-clause?" he asked.
"You'll have to wait." Vasvik was still watching him carefully. "For the extraction, I mean. We will extract you, and you will be paid what you ask. But we need you in place for another 3 to 6 months, until the Cambodia contract has matured."
"What the—"
Chris stopped himself with an effort of will and worked back to the easy confidence he'd come in with.
"What the fuck do you know about the Cambodia contract, Vasvik?"
"Probably more than you imagine."
The ombudsman made a dismissive gesture.
"But that isn't really the issue."
"No," snapped Chris. "The issue is you're fucking with me."
Vasvik smiled faintly. I don't believe a time frame was mentioned at any point. What did you think? I would come here and magic you out with one sweep of my UN wand. These things take time, Chris. You have to wait your turn. For a change.
Pushing. The realization seeped into Chris's consciousness, damping down the instinctive anger to an irritated curiosity. Why is he pushing me? The previous meeting in the workshop at Mel's. Vasvik's face, hard with distaste. Personally, Faulkner, I don't give a shit what happens to you. I think you're scum. The ethical commerce guys would like to hear what you have. That's why I'm here, but I'm no salesman. I don't have to reel you in to get my name up on some commission board somewhere, and frankly, I have a lot of better things to... But the ethical commerce guys have sent you back here, haven't they, Vasvik? Chris felt the answer light up in his head like an arcade game. You warned them not to bite, but they overruled you, and they sent you back for me. And now you've got to swallow that shit whole. Unless, that is, you can trip me into blowing out the offer of my own accord. He felt a grin building. The maneuvering room was immense, and at the back of it all he had Notley's avuncular indulgence spread like dark, protecting wings. He could run Vasvik ragged, grind his bony nose up against his own controller's orders to acquire Chris Faulkner at asking price, and even if he pushed the ombudsman over the edge and blew it, he could walk away from the wreckage of the deal. Fuck 'em, if they couldn't take a joke. He'd stay at Sean. All right. He sat back and nodded. Let's talk about Cambodia, then. The tension in the room eased. Carla seemed to sag slightly with it, and Chris saw how her hand fell on her father's shoulder. Eric reached up and clasped it without looking back from the drink he was mixing. Neither of them looked at Chris.
Good, said Vasvik. So, the way we see it at the moment, you've got Q-Sari on the customary long-leash arrangement, nominally acting in line with the accords you all signed up to, but in actual fact pretty much doing what he feels like. Recruiting from the villages that'll listen to him, burning the ones that won't. Standard terror tactics. My question is, what are you going to do about the Enterprise Zones?
Chris shrugged.
We've got an understanding with him about that whole area. Gentleman's agreement, nothing on paper.
I see. Any reason why he should stick to that any more than he's stuck to the Geneva Convention stuff so far?
Yeah. If he doesn't, we pull the plug on his mobile cover. Ever tried coordinating a guerrilla war by landline?
Eric Nyquist leaned over and handed Vasvik a tall glass. There was a conspicuous lack of a drink in his other hand as he turned to look at Chris, and a familiar anger rising on his face.
Very neat, Vasvik said thoughtfully.
Yeah, because that kind of thing matters, doesn't it, Chris? Can't have some first-world sportswear manufacturer losing productivity, can we?
Chris sighed.
Eric, you still got any of that Ardbeg non-chill filtered I bought you for your birthday?
No.
Ah. Can I get some of that cheap blended stuff you like, then?
Eric's right arm twitched at his side. Chris saw the fist knot up. Then Vasvik murmured something in Norwegian, and the older man stopped himself.
"Get your own fucking drink," he said, and stalked across to the window.
The police lights outside pricked the blue in his eyes as he stared downward. Chris shrugged, pulled a face at Vasvik, and rose to follow his father-in-law's advice. Carla turned away from him as he got there. She disappeared into the kitchen, arms wrapped around herself. Chris shrugged again. It was a view he was getting used to. He selected a clean glass and a bottle from the table, poured four fingers of something apparently called Clan Scott.
"I don't see where you're going with this, Vasvik," he said over his shoulder. "It's standard CI operating procedure. Protect the foreign capital base at all costs. Seri understands that, like all the rest of these toy revolutionaries. And presumably you have informed those with interests in the EZs that this is the state of play."
"Yeah, sure. Most of them are buying their protection through our reinsurance arm, anyway." Chris sniffed dubiously at the scotch and took it back to his armchair. "Why?"
"Did you know that Nakamura are modelling for a military coup against the Cambodian government?
No. Chris swallowed some of his drink and grimaced. Next door, the shouting seemed to be starting up again.
But it doesn't surprise me.
With Accra Politics still holding the official advisory angle, it'd be their only chance of carving themselves a slice of the action. Our INDESP guys should bring it in before they make any substantial moves.
Industrial espionage might give you backroom detail on the models, but it won't help you on the ground. What are you going to do if it looks like Nakamura can get the Cambodian army to do what they want?
Chris shrugged.
Call Langley, I suppose. Have the relevant uniforms capped at home.
At the window, Eric Nyquist made a noise in his throat. Chris glanced across at him.
"Hey, I'm sorry if that upsets your sensibilities, Eric, but this is the way the world is run."
"Yes, I know that."
"Fucking bastard," screamed the woman next door. The baby was crying again. Chris frowned into his drink.
"Well, Eric, maybe you prefer it if we left these generals with their skulls intact, and then they could roll their tanks out to play in the streets of Phnom Penh and slaughter a few thousand people."
"The way Kyusari is going to, you mean?"
"That's not the way we've modelled it."
"Oh, good."
Again, Vasvik said something in Norwegian, and Eric looked back out at the night. He seemed to see something of interest down below.
"Your friends are leaving," he said flatly. "That's obviously enough law enforcement for this month. We must have used up our credit."
"Hey, not my friends, Eric." Chris grinned at the older man. "I just paid them off, that's all. Just because I give someone money doesn't mean I like them. You should know that."
"The point," Vasvik said sharply, "is that we would like you to remain in position until the Nakamura move is completed one way or another. The Cambodian EZs are under investigation."
Chris hissed through his teeth.
"Yeah, so what else is new? Don't tell me you're actually getting ready to take someone to that joke court of yours."
Something smashed against the wall in the next flat. The male voice was back, competing for airtime with the woman. The baby's crying scaled up a couple of notches, maybe in an attempt to be heard over all the yelling. Chris raised an eyebrow and drank some more Clan Scott.
"We need inside information from after any move by the Cambodian military."
For all the change in Vasvik's voice, the fight going on next door could have been on TV.
"I don't want to disclose detail, but if we don't have clear data, then a number of the people we've got our eye on will be able to use the confusion of the coup to muddy the waters over their own actions. They'll get through the reasonable doubt loophole and they'll walk. We'll lose the whole case."
"Don't you usually?"
"Cunt, cunt, cunt," screamed the guy next door. "Fucking cunt!"
A blow, and someone falling. A broken shriek. The baby wailing. Carla came out of the kitchen as if fired from a gun.
"Dad, what the fuck is he doing to—"
"I know."
Eric came to take his daughter's hands. He looked suddenly very old.
It happens a lot. There's nothing you can do."
Vasvik stared into the middle distance with no more emotion than a cat. Another shriek. A meaty thump. Chris stared around and coughed out a laugh.
"You guys are fucking hysterical, you know that? Eric, with your fucking writing, and the fucking ombudsman here. All going to change the fucking world for the better."
Suddenly he was yelling himself.
"Look at yourselves! You're fucking paralyzed, all of you!"
Something hit the wall, big enough to be a body. Blows followed, regular, spaced, chanting.
"You cunt, like that? You cunt, like that? You fucking like that, cunt?"
He was in motion, and it was like the Saab ride home all over again, embodied purpose unstoppable. He went out, along the tiny entry hall, out the front door, left, along to the next door. He kicked it in. Cheap wood splintered in the frame, the door flew back, slammed into the wall, rebounded. He kicked again and erupted into the space beyond, through the hall and into the living room. They'd heard him come in. The woman was sprawled across the carpet, dressed in a short, moth-eaten grey terry-cloth robe and moving weakly like an injured soldier trying to crawl to cover. She was bleeding from the mouth. Below the hem of the robe, her thighs were mottled with old bruises. The baby was in a plastic carrier, marooned atop a cheap entertainment stack near the kitchen door, mouth open wide as if in surprise. The father was turning, garish purple shell-suit bottoms and a red sleeveless T-shirt tight across a boxer's physique. Meat, M-E-A-T, the rich, was inked across his chest in white capitals stretched wide. His eyes were defocused with fury, and his fists were clenched, blood on the knuckles of the right hand.
"You're making too much noise," said Chris.
"What?" The man blinked. The lack of uniform registered. Maybe the cut of Chris's clothes, too.
"Fuck are you doing in my house, cunt? You looking for a fucking fight?"
"Yeah."
Another blink.
"You fucking what?"
"Yeah, I'm looking for a fight."
For some reason, the answer seemed to stall the other man. Chris, who'd been worried about the baby, used the moment to take two neat steps sideways and give himself a clear field of fire. The other man gaped, as if the executive in front of him had just done a pirouette. Chris cleared the Nemex and pointed the weapon in a single, fluid move that he reckoned Louise Hewitt would have been proud of. The man gaped some more. "Never mind." Bang. Chris shot as low down the thigh as he trusted himself to hit. The target screamed and collapsed, clutching at his leg. Chris reversed his grip on the gun, stepped in close, and clubbed the man hard, sideways across the head. He went down, eyes rolled up. The woman on the floor shrieked and scuttled backward into a corner.
"It's okay," Chris said absently. "I won't hurt you."
"Chris!"
Carla stood in the doorway, face ashen, staring at him.
"It's okay. He's not dead."
Chris thought about it for a moment, then put the Nemex to the man's knee just below the first wound and pulled the trigger. The man jerked with the impact, but didn't come around. Carla and the other woman's screams seemed to blend in the wake of the shot. The baby started wailing again. He looked across at the woman, whose left eye was rapidly swelling closed, thought some more. He placed the Nemex muzzle on the man's right elbow.
"Chris, don't!"
And pulled the trigger again. Carla jerked back as if it was her he'd shot. He put the Nemex away and crossed to where the woman was crouched in the corner. He took out his wallet and gave her about half the cash he was carrying. "Listen," he said, pressing it into her hand. "Pay attention, listen. This is for you. Call him an ambulance if you like, but don't let them take him in. They'll try to. It's what they're paid to do. That's how they make the big money. Don't let them. They'll dress the wounds here if you ask them to. It's cheaper, and it's all he needs. He's not in danger. He won't die. Do you understand?" She just stared at him. He sighed and folded her hand around the money. She flinched as he touched her. He sighed again and got up, looked at the baby, the mess around him. He shook his head and turned away. They were all there now. Eric Nyquist, features tight with disgust. Carla, hugged in her father's arms, face buried in his chest. Vasvik, silent and impassive.
"What?" he asked them.
"What?" Chapter 37. The Land Rover jolted over another pothole, hard and too fast. Coins and other dashboard detritus cascaded onto the floor. Chris swayed in the grip of his seatbelt. He glanced across at Carla.
"You want to slow down a bit?"
She looked back at him, then away, said nothing. The Land Rover bounced again, high